You're listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C. Today, I'm excited to welcome Bradley Jardine to the show. Bradley is Managing Director at the Oxus Society for Central Asian Affairs, and his upcoming book, written with Edward Lemon, is titled Backlash, China's Struggle for Influence in Central Asia. Welcome to the podcast, Bradley.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here, finally.
Keen readers of The Diplomat will remember your name from our pages long ago and more recently. So it's nice to have you on the podcast finally. You know, I think there are a few stories as big in Central Asia as China over the last 15 years or so, its presence, its power, its influence, all on the rise. At the same time, I think Central Asia is often on the periphery of global geopolitical discourse. We don't always talk about Central Asia as being central. And so I'm really excited to have you on the podcast to talk about your book, because I think it really covers some of those themes. You know, in the introduction to Backlash, you write that Central Asia serves as a testing ground for China's foreign policy. So I kind of wanted to start there. You know, in what ways has China sort of used Central Asia as that testing ground? And what are maybe some of the features of that larger blueprint that we've then seen sort of subsequently deployed elsewhere?
Yeah, China's diplomacy in the region is very interesting, because we do see it as a place where China tends to test a lot of its concepts before it tries, implementing them in other regions, such as the Middle East, Latin America. You know, from the very early 90s, we saw this with, you know, the topic that I've long been working on of transnational repression. Central Asia is really the first region in the early 90s where China was looking, how do we control a foreign government's information space? How do we suppress Uyghur political mobilization, or even cultural things like museums, and getting deals with Central Asian governments tied in with those kind of political arrangements that would close civic space for Uyghurs? And that was decades before this became mass policy around the world. So that's kind of like an early example. A more well-known example would, of course, be the formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. A lot of the agreements on extradition treaties, and even the political alignments in the region, it starts in Central Asia. So it was really a place where China began its kind of multilateral fora that it's now kind of using in other parts of the world. And then, of course, you know, when the BRI was launched, that's China's flagship foreign policy concept, as we all know, it was launched in Kazakhstan. And that's not coincidental. It is the land corridor that does link the Eurasian landmass. It has historical ties with Silk Road diplomacy, of course. And that's the imagery that's often evoked in China's diplomatic engagements, which in itself is also an innovation in Central Asia, is where China started to test this kind of soft power Silk Road diplomacy. And we see it as far flung as from Africa to Latin America when China engages governments there. So I think Central Asia is very relevant for those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's hard to discuss China without talking about great power competition. We kind of always end up back at that topic when China comes up. How does Central Asia figure into that great power competition, obviously, between China and the United States? But Russia is obviously a big player in Central Asia.
Yeah, we've seen Central Asia's role evolve a lot over the years. Of course, early engagement with the U.S. was primarily through the war in Afghanistan and the logistical corridors that emerged. But in more recent years, we see a number of variants. I mean, first, there was, of course, the BRI, as we've discussed, China's kind of approach to a Western-centric trade order, often with maritime routes, presenting this land corridor as an alternative. Oil and gas, of course, the region is very energy rich. China's long tried to diversify its energy portfolio, especially away from dependence on maritime corridors, which are pretty susceptible to U.S. choke points. The land corridors in Central Asia and alternative supplies give China some strategic autonomy. It's very important. And then in more recent years, we've had, of course, with Russia's conflict in Ukraine, the region's become something of a hub for some sanctions evasion. So there's been a lot of discussions with the U.S. on how to close some of those loopholes. And of course, the European Union's interested in this as well. So in terms of Russia's foreign policy, Central Asia has been quite important in terms of giving Russia this flexibility in terms of its evading the sanctions regime. And even from other matters, diplomatic things, which of course China's crackdown in Xinjiang, China often leverages Central Asian governments to support at fora such as the UN to get some backing for a lot of its policies. And even now, of course, a topic that everyone keeps talking about in DC is critical minerals. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about that, I feel, with the region, which is really making use of its vast critical minerals deposits. You know, a lot of studies show that the region might have something between 25 and 27 of the 54 U.S. government recognized critical minerals. So that's becoming a real issue that's being talked up. The region has always been savvy at multi-vector foreign policies, kind of playing great powers off one another to benefit from a lot of these rivalrous dynamics. So, of course, they're playing up this idea that, oh, China has a monopoly on critical minerals. We also have a lot that could be strategically useful if you're willing to make a deal. And mm-hmm. so there's been a lot of talk, a very limited follow-through so far. But it'd be very interesting to see how that develops in the coming years.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to ask about critical minerals. Now I don't have to. The next part of that, however, is, you know, we tend to talk a lot about how China approaches a region, but how do Central Asian governments approach and handle China? You talked a little bit about that, but can you expand on sort of how Central Asian governments and there's five of them, so they all have sort of different policies and different strategies. But in general, how do they approach China and how are they sort of using this opportunity?
Yeah, the Central Asian governments themselves have long courted China. It's a source of investment where it's been lacking abilities to kind of engage in these large-scale projects, whether it's developing ports, railway infrastructure to help kind of overcome their landlocked dynamic. Investments in their oil and gas industries. The Central Asian regimes have long been courting Chinese elites and kind of getting that investment. They do this for a number of means, of course, engaging in, as I mentioned earlier, supporting China multilaterally or at fora such as the UN. These are often political concessions that the region is willing to make in order to get Chinese economic support. One of the things that backlash, actually, one of the reasons we wrote the book was that a lot of focus is made on China's elite-led diplomacy. You know, that China often comes to these regions of top-down governance structures, authoritarian, and so it makes deals with the regime's leaders themselves, and the public are largely ignored. But one thing that's been interesting over the years is we map a lot of public protests mm-hmm. and we kind of show how civil society, despite the authoritarian nature of the region, civil society does put checks on the government. It does create pushback on certain policies, and the regimes often have to do an about turn with some initiatives because of the controversy that they generate. And this also feeds into the way they engage China, that oftentimes, especially as Sinophobia has been rising in recent years, there's often a really complex game where elites want Chinese money and investment, but there are actors from a broad range of ideologies. We have everything from extremist groups to ultra-conservatives to left-wing environmental activists who will point out that some of these projects undermine sovereignty or national interests, and their accusations that the elites are, you know, sellouts or selling out their nation for Chinese money. And so these kind of constraints have really made it complicated in recent years for Central Asia's leaders to deal with China. It's often difficult for them to be very openly pro-China. They have to have mixed messaging in the way they talk to their population versus how they communicate with China. And I think that that's been especially interesting on the Xinjiang issue, where a lot of people don't realize that there are a lot of ethnic Kazakhs and Kyrgyz across the border in Xinjiang. Many have been detained. And so there's families in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan who've been putting a lot of pressure on their government to intervene or to get people released. And that's resulted in a lot of back-channel diplomacy, where the Kazakh government in particular has actually worked to get people released from these camps. So these kind of things, it just shows the complications that Central Asia's leaders have had in recent years in their dealings with China and these constraints and kind of the type of projects they can actually take on now.
Yeah, I'm really glad you sort of brought up this divergence really between sort of elites that want to engage China and want Chinese money for things, but also the fact that China is not always that popular on the local level among sort of the publics. And I don't have to tell anybody, but Central Asia is not sort of a wellspring of democracy. And so I'm curious, in the writing of this book, sort of the observations you had about how people do communicate to their government their dissatisfaction, and maybe under what circumstances does that have an impact versus when it's sort of swept under the rug anyway? Because I think we've seen examples of both.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, one of the things with studying protest movements is just looking at how they've evolved in recent years. Of Central Asia, we cover everything from, of course, on-the-ground protests. There are a lot of stage protests outside embassies, consulates, foreign embassies as well. So for the Xinjiang issue, there are protesters that gather almost every single day and continue to do so outside the Chinese consulate, raising awareness of their family members who continue to be detained. Social media has been a massive game changer for the region. It adds a virality to a lot of campaigns that often kind of got lost in the weeds, especially in Central Asia, where we see protests are often heavily concentrated in urban centers, you know, major cities, often rural populations, their issues are often completely ignored. But with social media, you've really seen the way that localized issues can actually take on national prominence. And people often are quite savvy in the way, this is one thing we explore in the book, is the way that people are quite savvy in their messaging. Oftentimes when we see anti-China protests, sometimes the issue doesn't have much to do with China, which is very interesting. Is it because they know that there's a wider skepticism of China, that even tying in an issue or suggesting it has some sort of China angle is actually a way to build traction in major cities with some of these more conservative or nationalist-leaning elites who kind of want issues to mobilize around as well. So you often see strange things like protests about welfare plans that will involve a lot of placards that are anti-China because locals will try to blame China for the collapse in welfare for example, mothers with disabled children. This was like a big active movement in Kazakhstan for a while. And it would often have these anti-China signs. So that was something that we kind of focused on earlier, was just seeing how messaging in the region changes and people capitalize on Sinophobic sentiments for this reason. But of course, the other thing with social media, like we're dealing with in the West, is there's a spread of misinformation. Issues can kind of take on a life of their own. Uh-huh. I think you really saw that with a couple of recent mass protests in Kazakhstan, the land reform protests that were just some of the largest in the country's history. That was a lot of misrepresentation over the scale of foreign land ownership, especially Chinese land ownership. And then recent things that caught out in Kazakhstan about China buying up 50 factories, you know, that became another huge movement, which, you know, was grounded a lot on misinformation. So it just shows that with social media, and this is the thing that we like to point out, that because China hasn't invested much in soft power and there's a lot of skepticism of China, it's created a lot of vulnerabilities for messaging that a lot of actors from all kinds of political persuasions, they could really exploit the China issue and use misinformation even to undermine governments or to gain competitive edge where they wouldn't have had it previously, just because they can exploit this information vacuum.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Before we close out, I want to switch gears just a tiny bit because we are recording on October 31st. No, it won't be a Halloween question, but next week on November 6th, the five Central Asian presidents are expected now in Washington for a summit with U.S. President Donald Trump. While I have you, I wanted to, you know, ask what you're watching most closely when it comes to this upcoming presidential summit. It'll be the second such summit, the first that'll be in Washington, and how you sort of see Central Asia fitting into U.S. foreign policy. We already talked a little bit about critical minerals, but that's obviously a big one. But any other ways that you see it sort of fitting into the current, frankly, unusual state of U.S. foreign policy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question and something that I'll be thinking a lot in this coming week. Of course, we mentioned the critical minerals aspect. We've seen with Trump's recent agreements with Malaysia, for example, that there is an emphasis on the U.S. government kind of making these deals regarding critical minerals. So I think that that could open up some space for possibly some action. So I'm obviously that's the thing I'm probably focused on most. The other is, of course, counter-violent extremism. That's a topic that continues to concern the U.S., especially with this current government's emphasis on border security, American security. We've had issues that we've been monitoring where we look at across the with the Mexican border. We've had extremist groups based in Central Asia who have, you know, allegedly snuck individuals across into the U.S. border. There's a major kind of FBI-led operation last year where a number of Central Asians were detained and deported who had been connected with groups like ISK. So I do think that there'll be a lot of discussion around terrorism and U.S. security as well.
All right. Awesome. Well, for our listeners, remember the book is Backlash, China's Struggle for Influence in Central Asia. If you're in the UK, I think it's already on shelves and it will be out in the United States soon. Thanks for joining me, Bradley, so much. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thanks again for having me. I enjoyed that.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, to The Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics podcast. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you don't miss out on future episodes. You can now also watch these episodes on YouTube if that is your thing. And as always, you can get in touch with me or my co-host Ankit, who will be back soon with episode suggestions or questions. We'll be back soon with more. Thank you.